will be wild. The far-right Proud Boys are expected to be among the pro-Trump crowd in the Capitol. William Cohen told the Washington Post he was concerned by the mention of the possibility of martial law by the former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, especially after Donald Trump's use of the military and other federal forces to remove protesters outside the White House last June. "It's a very dangerous course of action that needs to be called out before it happens," William Cohen said. "It is so important to see the country's secretaries of defense sending this message," wrote Risa Brooks, a Marquette University associate professor studying civil-military relations and political violence. Risa Brooks wrote, "The civilians who run the military need to be front and center in conveying this message to the public and not leave it to the military alone." Meanwhile, 12 Republican senators who have pledged not to ratify the Electoral College result this Wednesday and thereby refused to confirm Joe Biden's resounding victory over Donald Trump in the presidential election declined to defend their move on television, CNN declared on Sunday, 3rd of January. "It all recalls what Ulysses S. Grant once wrote in 1861, CNN anchor Jake Tapper said on State of the Union. Before quoting a letter, the Union General, Ulysses S. Grant, wrote at the outset of a civil war he won before becoming president himself. "There are but two parties now, traitors and patriots." "How would you describe the parties today?" Jake Tapper asked. The attempt to overturn Trump's defeat seems doomed, a piece of political theater mounted by party grandees eager to court supporters loyal to the president before, in some cases, mounting their own runs for the White House. Nonetheless, on Saturday, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin led 11 senators and senators-elect in calling for an emergency 10-day audit of results in states where the president claims electoral fraud, despite failing to provide any evidence and repeatedly losing in courts of law. The senators followed Josh Hawley of Missouri, like Ted Cruz, likely to run for president in 2024, in pledging to object to the Electoral College result. A majority of House Republicans are also expected to object, after staging a Saturday call with Donald Trump to plan their own moves. Democrats control the House of Representatives, and senior Senate Republicans are opposed to the attempt to disenfranchise millions of Americans, many of them African Americans in swing states, seemingly guaranteeing the attempt will fail. Nonetheless, the current Vice President Mike Pence, who will preside over the ratification, welcomed the move by Senator Ted Cruz and others. A spokesman for Joe Biden, Michael Gwynn, said, "This stunt won't change the fact that President-elect Joe Biden will be sworn in on 20th of January, and these baseless claims have already been examined and dismissed by Trump's own Attorney General, dozens of courts of law, and election officials from both parties.
President-elect Joe Biden has formally announced many of his cabinet picks, boasting the most diverse cabinet in United States history. So who are these appointees? What are their records? And what are we really going to see from this incoming administration? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Joe Biden, whose campaign was practically dead in the water barely a year ago during the Democratic primaries, is now the president-elect of the United States. Things took a surprising turn when, during the Democratic primaries, several candidates all dropped out simultaneously and pledged their support behind Joe Biden, making the race a de facto head-to-head between him and Bernie Sanders. This Machiavellian move, with Obama making a few phone calls behind the scenes, cemented Joe Biden's status as the so-called frontrunner and saw the race narrow in his favor. Bernie Sanders soon dropped out and, just like he did in 2016, rallied behind the Democratic nominee without any opposition, rolling over and abandoning his grassroots movement of workers without obtaining any policy concessions from Biden. Bernie Sanders supporters and the progressive wing of the party were told once again that they absolutely needed to vote for the Democratic nominee for Biden because Donald Trump was an existential threat to the United States and that Biden was somehow the lesser of two evils. The Democratic Party knew it could count on them. It knew it could count on millions of Bernie supporters who had been sheepdogged back into the party. So why bother appeasing the left? Instead, we saw the Democratic Party invite neocon war criminals like Colin Powell to speak at their convention. The formation of groups like Republicans for Biden. Or even worse, the heinous Lincoln Project, a group of neoconservative war criminals from the Bush era like Rick Wilson, Bill Kristol, and Dick Cheney's daughter, making the case for Joe Biden. In essence, the Democratic Party and Biden's campaign tried more to appeal to right-wing voters and Republicans than to the left wing of their own party because no one was pressuring them from the left. And besides, that's exactly what Democrats are anyway. They are right-wingers. Even policies supported by most Americans, both Republican and Democrat, like universal health care, were frowned upon by Biden. Biden flat out said that he would veto Medicare for All. Just looking at Joe Biden's record, having spent 40 years in Congress catering to credit card companies, to Wall Street, to the fossil fuel industry, authoring the 94 crime bill and jailing scores of young African-American men, helping to start the Iraq War and supporting virtually every U.S. military intervention, Joe Biden even shamelessly bragged about working with segregationists. Despite all of this, Americans were told that they needed to blindly pledge their vote for Joe Biden in order to get rid of Trump. We heard over and over how Americans must put aside their grievances, shut up, and vote for the blue war criminal because he was supposedly different from the red war criminal. In the words of Joe Biden's own wife, voters were told to swallow a little. All of this under the premise that once Joe Biden was elected, voters would be able to push him left. So here we are, months later, Joe Biden has won and been declared president-elect. And already he's walked back several of his campaign promises, including canceling student loan debts and rolling back Trump's immigration policies. Not only that, but he's made several key appointments to his cabinet, many of them familiar faces, old pals from the Obama days. The same people who took the United States from two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to seven wars in Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan. The same people who expanded the NSA's mass surveillance programs, who sold billions of dollars to the Saudi Arabian regime in order to commit genocide in Yemen. The same people who dismantled the anti-war and Occupy movements. The same people who gave bailouts to Wall Street while forcing millions of Americans out of their homes. The same corporatist criminals and their neoliberal policies who led to Trump in the first place. So while Trump picked a cabinet of crooks who were DC outsiders, Biden also picks a bunch of crooks, but at least they're DC insiders. In fact, this very much pleases the liberal elites and the corporate establishment media. Why? Because of diversity, allegedly. Joe Biden bragged that his cabinet is the most diverse in United States history. These appointments have, of course, been lauded and praised by the mainstream media because they mean nothing in terms of structural change and have no effect on the goals of the U.S. empire. The liberal elites and the media establishment can continue to pretend that they celebrate minorities and people of color while oppressing those very same groups, both at home and abroad, under the veil of intersectional, rainbow-colored imperialism. So far, Joe Biden has appointed seven women to his White House communications team. He also appointed Neera Tanden to head the Office of Management and Budget. This is the same Neera Tanden, Clinton aide, who suggested in an email that Arab countries should pay the United States with their oil for invading them. Biden has tapped Avril Haines as the director of national intelligence, a former deputy director of the CIA, and an architect of Obama's horrific drone program, which has killed countless civilians across the Middle East. But I guess we shouldn't worry, right? Because she's a woman, and according to the New York Times, she's also a brown belt in judo, a pilot, and turned an old bar into a bookstore. Biden's foreign policy advisor, Tony Blinken, will now be his Secretary of State. Blinken is another familiar face from the Obama administration and a supporter of the imperialist wars on Libya, Syria, and Yemen. He signaled that Biden would continue to use the CSAR Act sanctions, keep U.S. troops inside of Syria, and continue occupying Syria's oil, just as Trump has done. Yet according to The Guardian, these minor transgressions should be overlooked because Blinken can apparently speak French and play the guitar. So I'm sure this will be very appreciated by many Syrians who are currently starving under America's sanctions. Or what about Biden's pick for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, an African-American woman who also happens to serve as the vice president on leave to a Swiss mining company called Glencore, which is currently facing corruption charges in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These are just a few of the wonderful imperialists and corporatists that Joe Biden has appointed to his cabinet under the banner of so-called diversity. So joining me to discuss these cabinet picks further is Kevin Gostola, journalist and managing editor at Shadowproof. It's good to have you on, Kevin. How are you?
Yeah, thank you.
Kevin, you've been doing some great coverage on Joe Biden's new cabinet picks. We've been seeing a lot of familiar faces from the Obama days. Is that just a coincidence?
Well, what we're seeing are the people who have the leadership in the Democratic Party, the people who are going to be boosted. That's an amalgamation of Clinton Democrats, and then you have Obama Democrats. These are kind of the establishment factions that have sort of been at war with each other. Well, they've always had a shared interest to suppress any kind of insurgency from the wing of the party that I usually call the Sanders wing or the Sanders Democrats or maybe the Justice Democrats. And so politically, that's what we see happening. And, you know, to be quite honest, the progressives just really don't have much power to match the influence of the Obama Democrats or the Clinton Democrats. And so what you have is, especially when it comes to foreign policy, you have, you know, the weakest of appeals to liberal imperialism, basically. Like, the disagreements, the arguments are over whether you're going to have a more humanitarian kind of foreign policy that is still interventionist, or you're going to just ditch human rights entirely and show force and wield it with a kind of iron fist globally. And so what you're getting now is the alternative brand of U.S. empire that Biden is about to put forward. We've had 4 years of Donald Trump. We've seen what that could do. It turned off the entire globe, but that doesn't mean that what we're going to get from Joe Biden is going to necessarily be, you know, peace and human rights.
Speaking of foreign policy and empire specifically, can you tell us a bit more about Biden's new defense secretary? We're hearing praise from the media that he is the first black man to lead the Pentagon.
His name is Lloyd Austin, and he's a remarkable figure because it seems like no matter what in the United States, you can't keep people out of our government who have passed in the Iraq War. Lloyd Austin is the fact that he was involved in leading the invasion of Iraq and has boasted about going so quickly from, I believe, Kuwait to the Baghdad city in like a record amount of time. He was able to move forces and go in there and seize Baghdad. And this is his, what he considers to be the most honorable part of his military career, if you read it. And then he pairs it, I think disingenuously, with being involved in the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. However, he and Joe Biden and other Democrats are terrible at how they spin the Iraq withdrawal, because those troops were only, for the most part, removed expeditiously because they were afraid that the Iraqi government was going to start holding U.S. soldiers accountable for war crimes, which was a thing that was a sticking point to a status of forces agreement. So any work that was done to ultimately remove troops from Iraq, first off, I don't see that being like, hey, a tribute to you for removing forces that shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's like, they, like, it's like, okay, you led this and you know how to remove invaders from a foreign country. Like, great.
Right.
But then there's the issue of the fact that he was at a company called United Technologies that within the last year completed a merger with Raytheon and is now part of one of the biggest weapons manufacturers in the world. There is some truth to the fact that, like, I shouldn't treat him any differently than other Pentagon secretaries. So we've heard that he's a black man, and we should be excited because we're going to have the first black Pentagon secretary in United States history. Okay, but he's also the first black Pentagon military industrial complex leader of the entire world. You know, that's his claim. That's going to be his claim to fame too. And he'll be following in the footsteps of Mark Esper and James Mattis and Patrick Shanahan, who were Trump's defense secretaries, and they all came from defense contractors or weapons companies. In fact, Mark Esper, who he's succeeding, came from Raytheon. So it's as if Raytheon has completely taken control of the Pentagon. Essentially, the revolving door isn't even really a revolving door anymore. It's just a complete pipeline from Raytheon to the Pentagon in order for it to funnel money into the coffers of Raytheon for the bombing of children in Yemen or wherever Saudi Arabia might need us to assist them in the Middle East next.
Kevin, thank you so much for your amazing reporting, your insight, and all your analysis. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast by IRIB English Radio.
So, Kevin, what about all these women that Biden has appointed as well? Because the mainstream media is saying we should all be happy that he's putting so many women in key positions of power. However, when you look at the records, Avril Haines, for example, you know, Joe Biden boasts that he has the most diverse cabinet. But what does that mean in this case? What kind of diversity are we really talking about here?
I'd like to give a nod to a journalist who I recently had the opportunity to interview, Roberto Lovato. There's a fantastic book right now on the violence and the interconnectedness of El Salvador and the United States. But he calls this intersectional empire. And that's what we're seeing under Joe Biden, is that we're bringing in all these figures to just have a more multicultural kind of an empire. You know, it's basically going to be an empire that looks like our country. And that's something that people are going to have to confront head on and stop falling for appointing, you know, women or Latinos or gays and lesbians or transgender people. You know, like, without going too far away from, I want to highlight Avril Haines specifically because I think she deserves attention, but without going too far away, there's actually a transgender person who was on his agency review team for his Biden, for the Biden transition. And I couldn't help but laugh because it's a transgender person who's a vet, but it's also somebody who's a contractor for CACI, which was involved in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal was implicated. So the representation that transgender people are getting in Biden's transition is coming from a contractor guilty of torture in Iraq. That's not representation, I think. I think we have to be clear here. I'm not trying to denigrate any group of people, but I'm saying if you really want representation, you need to be putting more demands on political elites, because what you don't want is reinforcing the white heteronormative patriarchy. And I think, like, it's fair to put it that way, because what they're doing is they're weaponizing you against people around the world. And so you have Avril Haines, who's coming in. The director of national intelligence position is what she's been picked to be a part of. And she's significant because she is a John Brennan loyalist. She was at the CIA. She was involved in further entrenching the assassination complex for drone warfare and the kill list. She's involved in, you know, they celebrate her as if, like, she was concerned about international law and she forced them to have a better process and to do more and then just quit killing people every Terror Tuesday with reckless abandon. But what this means is that it just became a more formal part of U.S. government. It was no longer easy to question what Barack Obama was doing. I mean, as he even admits in his latest memoir, he talks about how, like, easy it was to be killing people, essentially. And so, you know, that's what she was involved in. And she came from Palantir, too. She was at Palantir, which is a major security contractor that is implicated in, like, the deportations of immigrants. And the thing that's remarkable, too, is she was at a think tank called CNAS that is funded by oil companies, weapons companies, but it also got money from the director of national intelligence, that office which she is now going to be a chair of or running as a director. And then it also received money from Palantir. So it's just amazing. Like, when you think about the revolving doors of these people, it's just so incestuous.
So speaking of actually obtaining something substantive, what are progressives getting from this administration and these cabinet picks? People were told that they have to vote for Joe Biden, that he's the lesser of two evils, and once he's elected, you can push him left. Okay, well, I don't see Bernie Sanders' name anywhere on this list. So what are progressives getting exactly from this administration?
The only thing that I think you could say we might gain from a Biden administration is that we won't be bombing Iran. But we also know that we were never going to do that unless the Pentagon changed its calculus, because they've always had their own analysis that says that they would never be able to succeed militarily the way they want to. And so that's always held them back from doing more than just, like, enlisting Israel to go assassinate nuclear scientists or engaging in cyber warfare with things like Stuxnet to just completely dismantle the infrastructure. But that's Barack Obama. That's where Joe Biden is going next. We're going to see that kind of hybrid warfare. And so I think people really need to be aware that what we have now with a Joe Biden administration is a ramping up of tensions with Russia, a ramping up of tensions with China. The great power competition is going to be extremely fierce. And then with Iran, like, I don't know what they're supposed to do. The government and all the officials didn't do anything wrong when it came to the nuclear deal. Donald Trump decided to completely scrap it. And then now, somehow, in order to get the U.S. back into it, I'm afraid that Joe Biden's going to force Iran to make some kind of concessions, even though they never left the deal. So why should they have to do it? Like, why should they have to be the ones that give anything up? It should be the United States that gives Iran something in order to be back in the nuclear deal, in order to have this agreement. And so I think you asked the right question, which is, what are progressives gaining from this cabinet when it comes to foreign policy? I mean, look at the bill that just passed for the government that had the stimulus package. It contains funding for democracy promotion programs. It contains funding for more of the intervention and regime change operations in Venezuela. It contains funding for the war on drugs in the Caribbean. It contains funding for helping activists continue to destabilize Hong Kong just so that they can drive a wedge between China and any other countries in the region that it's trying to work with and cooperate with. And so I'm really concerned here. And then the other thing with these people who are in the cabinet that we have to address is that they're completely hawkish on Syria and favor arms being sent to Syria. And also, you've had situations where the Pentagon's funding their own groups that end up going to war with CIA-funded groups. So it's a total satire.
Right. I mean, these picks are total jokes. Pete Buttigieg, a small-town mayor, he's now the transport secretary. The former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, you know, her field of so-called expertise is predominantly foreign policy, yet now she'll be leading the domestic policy council. What are all these weird picks? Is there something transactional or nefarious going on here as opposed to something based on expertise?
It's transactional. And let me just disclose that I'm actually from the same hometown area that Pete Buttigieg is from. So I have a little insight into the fact that, you know, as far as his transportation experience, he really has none. But what I can tell you is there's a commuter train that runs between that area. There's a commuter train that runs between Chicago and northern Indiana that now he'll be able to use the same way that Mitch McConnell's wife was able to use as transportation secretary. So, you know, what this means is that he'll be able to jump to the front of line and get federal grants funneled to northern Indiana ahead of every other part of the United States. So it's just going to be an opportunity for Pete Buttigieg to get the gravy train going and put him in a good spot so that he can run for president again and make everybody feel good that he did a nice job as transportation secretary. Meanwhile, he has no knowledge of these systems. And then you raise the issue of Susan Rice. She couldn't get confirmed in a Senate. She never could get confirmed in the Senate because of what she did in Libya. So what are they going to do? Give her a domestic policy council position, which has nothing to do with her field of expertise at all.
I think it's frankly hilarious that anyone would expect anything different from a candidate who told rich donors that nothing would fundamentally change. We can clearly see that Joe Biden is not only returning the favor to those who stood aside for him to clinch the presidency, but just like all presidents before him, he is catering to the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, and the rest of corporate America. Once again, we see the formation of a cabinet run not by the American people, but by the oligarchy and multinational corporations. Joe Biden may be appointing all these women, women of color, people of color, to his cabinet. His cabinet might be diverse in race, orientation, and gender, but it is by no means diverse in terms of policy. What's the point of having a black Secretary of Defense if he's going to keep bombing black and brown people on the other side of the planet? What's the point of appointing a woman Director of National Intelligence if she helps drone strike and displace other women? You know, if Biden cares about women, wouldn't it have been better to not support the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen that has forced critical essential services and clinics to shut down, leaving scores of women without the necessary medical services that they require? As Eric London writes a few weeks ago, quote, "These servants of Wall Street and U.S. imperialism have nothing in common with the working people of their own race, gender, or sexual orientation. It is class, not identity, which is the fundamental dividing line in American society. This intersectional imperialism is just a facade in order to continue the same brutal policies of the U.S. empire, exploiting workers, killing and robbing people of color, all for the enrichment of the corporate elites. This pandering is an attempt to portray Biden's incoming administration as being more inclusive and diverse, implying that its tenure will be more in tune to the needs of these same minorities. But at the end of the day, these cabinet picks are all part of the same DC clique. They've spent their entire careers serving corporate interests and climbing the political ladder, and the last thing on their minds is serving the needs of their constituents, never mind those of their same race, gender, or orientation. Many people around the globe are rightfully cautious and skeptical about anything changing under Biden, and very conscious of the fact that the American empire continues just as it is, regardless of who is in the driver's seat. It's time perhaps for Americans to wake up to that as well. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has come under heavy pressure from President Trump to back an unconstitutional scheme to overturn his election defeat in a joint session of Congress, says Igor Derish Ryder in an article published under the heading, Trump Loyalists Sue Mike Pence to Give Him Power to Overturn Election Results. Here's the details. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has come under heavy pressure from President Trump to back an unconstitutional scheme to overturn his election defeat in a joint session of Congress. According to multiple reports, advisors have repeatedly had to explain to the president that the vice president's role is merely ceremonial. Trump has lost every legal challenge after failing to show evidence of fraud or irregularities and is now laser-focused on January 6th, when Pence will preside over a joint session of Congress to formally count the electoral votes. As his last stand for overturning the electoral outcome, multiple administration officials told the New York Times' Maggie Haberman. Trump has demanded that Pence act to stop the ratification of the Electoral College, which cast 306 votes for Biden and 232 for Trump earlier this month, according to CNN. Sources told CNN that Trump has been confused about why Pence cannot overturn the results on January 6th, even as Pence and White House aides have tried to explain to him that his role is more of a formality and he cannot unilaterally reject the Electoral College votes. Trump has raged at Pence and top White House officials in recent days as they have pushed back on his doomed scheme and would view Pence carrying out his constitutional duty and validating the election result as the ultimate betrayal, according to Axios' Jonathan Swan. This pressure arguably puts Pence in a bind since legally he cannot do anything to affect the result. The vice president reportedly plans to flee Washington for his first overseas trip since the coronavirus pandemic began right after the session. Pence's constitutional role is to open their certificates. That is it, said Harry Littman, a former Justice Department official and constitutional law expert at UCLA. Not to certify. Not even technically to count. He has no way even to purport to change the count. It would be like saying the Oscar presenters get to decide who wins Best Picture. The idea that Pence is going to overturn the election in January is pure fantasy land nonsense. Justin Levitt, an election law expert at Loyola Marymount University, told Vice News. The 12th Amendment of the Constitution requires each state to submit its Electoral College results to the President of the Senate, who is the Vice President. The Electoral Count Act of 1877, which was passed after several states tried to send rival sets of electoral ballots to be considered by Congress in 1876 election, lays out the rules governing objections to the results. Objections to individual state returns must be made in writing by at least one member each of the Senate and House of Representatives. If an objection meets these requirements, the joint session recesses and the two houses separate and debate the question in their respective chambers for a maximum of 2 hours, according to the Congressional Research Service. The two houses then vote separately to accept or reject the objection. They then reassemble in joint session and announce the results of their respective votes. An objection to a state's electoral vote must be approved by both houses in order for any contested votes to be excluded. The Vice President does not have a role to play in the objection process except to preserve order at the session. This authority may be interpreted as encompassing the authority to decide questions of order, but the statute is not explicit on this point, according to CRS. Nothing in either the text of the Constitution or the Electoral Count Act gives the Vice President any substantive powers. Legal experts Neil Katyal and John Monsky wrote in New York Times op-ed. Moreover, the law applies to dueling slates of electors approved by state legislatures. Although Republicans staged alternative meetings in states where Trump has disputed the results and appointed what they deemed alternate slates of electors, these have not been authorized by any state legislature or Secretary of State. In other words, they are effectively fake electors. None of this has stopped Trump loyalists from engaging in frantic scenarios. White House advisor Stephen Miller bragged about the phony electors on Fox News earlier this month, claiming that an alternate state of electors in the contested states is going to vote and we are going to send those results up to Congress. Pence and Trump recently met with a group of congressional Republicans to discuss a plan by Representative Mo Brooks, who plans to try to challenge the Electoral College results from at least 6 contested states. Several House Republicans have said they plan to join Brooks in challenging the results in Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Georgia, Wisconsin, and perhaps other states. Brooks would need a senator to join the effort in order to lodge a written challenge. No senator has firmly stated that he or she will join the effort, although Senators Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Ron Paul of Kentucky, as well as Senator-elect Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, who will take office on January 3rd, have signaled that they are open to the idea. But even if lawmakers lodge a challenge, federal law only allows for a 2-hour debate on whether to disqualify a state's votes. The lawmakers also plan to give a lengthy series of 5-minute speeches that could delay the vote for several more hours. But in the end, a majority of both chambers of Congress, including the Democratic-led House, would have to vote to disqualify a state's results, and that appears impossible. Democrats have decried the effort, while numerous moderate Republicans have similarly rejected the plan. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has urged Republican senators not to join the effort. Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number two Republican in the Senate, predicted that the effort would go down like a shot dog. A similar scenario played out in 2005 when a group of Democrats led by Ohio Representative Stephanie Tubbs-Jones and California Senator Barbara Boxer filed an objection to Ohio's results after alleging numerous serious election irregularities. The challenge was roundly defeated by a 267-31 vote by the House and 47-1 vote in the Senate, effectively just delaying the certification for several hours. The January 6th meeting is going to confirm that regardless of how many objections get filed and who signs on, they're not going to affect the outcome of the process. Edward Foley, a constitutional law expert at Ohio State University, told the New York Times, "Republicans evidently realize that their effort violates the law." So a group of Trump loyalists actually filed a lawsuit against Pence recently, arguing that the electoral count unconstitutionally prevents him from exercising full authority over which votes to count, and asking a judge to overthrow the existing rules in order to allow Pence to handpick the president. Legal experts have roundly dismissed the lawsuit. If the 12th Amendment somehow gave the vice president the power to unilaterally throw out electoral votes for the other guy in favor of their own party and even themselves, one might think that one of them would have noticed by now, wrote Steve Veladek, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Bottom line, there is no secret legal maneuver left to stop a Biden presidency. Pence and McConnell understand these rules and are in an awkward political position of their own sad making, tweeted Jed Shagerman, a professor at the Fordham University School of Law. Any drama before or on January 6th will be merely a pathetic show of Trump loyalty or cowardice. Though Trump's legal efforts and attempt to subvert the Electoral College results were doomed to fail from the beginning, his false claims about irregularities have swayed many Republican voters who have contributed more than $170 million to an effort that his team claims funds his election challenges, but largely just flows money into his personal PAC. Representative Adam Kinzinger ripped Trump and his Republican supporters over the weekend, describing the entire effort as a grifting scam. All that is being done is certain members of Congress, the president, and thought leaders on Twitter are getting retweets, getting followers, and raising money on this scam, he told CNN. It is a scam, and it is going to disappoint the people that believe this election was stolen, that think this is an opportunity to change it.
Tensions between Iran and the United States have mounted in recent days ahead of the assassination anniversary of the Iranian top general Qasem Soleimani. But the two sides were at loggerheads for quite some time. In December, the U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iran of playing a role in a series of rocket attacks that targeted the U.S. embassy in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, threatening retaliation. During his 4 years in office, Trump has time and again signaled intentions to launch an attack on Iran. Just last November, after being heavily defeated in the presidential election, Trump was reportedly asking senior advisors about potential options for attacking Iran's main nuclear site. A range of senior advisors dissuaded the outgoing president from moving ahead with a military strike. They warned that a strike against Iran's facilities could easily escalate into a broader conflict in the last weeks of Trump's presidency. Analysts say that Trump could trigger a conflict with Iran to distract from his failing attempts to overturn his election loss and to complicate his successor's plans for the region. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation on his way out the door. Even Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has said that Trump is creating a pretext for war. All this is playing out as Biden prepares to enact his own policies after his January 20 inauguration. Biden, on many occasions, has said that he wants to ease Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran and return to the Iran nuclear deal. These are all the steps that hawks in the Trump administration vehemently oppose. Over the past couple of weeks, the U.S. military has beefed up its presence in the region. In mid-December, a U.S. Navy-guided missile submarine made an unusual transit of the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. Earlier in December, a pair of B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana flew what the military called a presence mission over the Persian Gulf. That flight was repeated a week later, with two B-52s flying nonstop from North Dakota and heading home after cruising over the western side of the Persian Gulf. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, noted that the U.S. increased military presence in West Asia stems from Washington's fear of the consequences of its past acts of mischief in this region. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, also vowed harsh retaliation against any aggression targeting the country.
We will respond to any move by the enemy with a harder and reciprocally more resolute blow. This has been proven time and time again. We say the same thing today. We will not spare the enemy and will not leave it alone.
Last week, Iran issued a stern warning to the UN Security Council about the U.S.'s recent provocative moves in the region. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the UN raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of the consequences. The letter also echoed Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said that Iran does not seek war, but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests.
On the morning of January the 3rd, 2020, the world woke up to the news that top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani had been martyred in Baghdad by a US drone strike, killing General Soleimani and his entourage. The assassination came as Lieutenant General Soleimani had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government as part of his ongoing mission to fight terrorism in the region, terrorism that saw the Daesh group firmly in the sights of the Iranian military hero. The killing of General Soleimani was unlawful, as UN rapporteur Agnes Callamard clearly pointed out in her report following the assassination, suggesting a legal case against the perpetrators was the way forward. With the ultimate decision to perform the strike on the convoy of General Soleimani lying solely at the feet of the US president, it seems that Iran has a clear case against Trump for the charge of a war crime, as there was no justification for the killing, as confirmed in the UN report. However, the fact that the assassination took place and very little has been done on an international scale to condemn the murder, it appears to have given a green light to other nations to take illegal actions against Iran, in particular the recent example of the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, with officials stating that there had been strong indications that the Israeli regime had been involved in the attack.
Yes, certainly there has to be accountability for this. this violent and illegal assassination of General Soleimani. The United States, of course, has always felt it is above the law. It doesn't have to maintain any kind of respect for international law or human rights. And that is one of the reasons that the Donald Trump administration proceeded with this assassination. However, this sends the wrong message to the world community. If the United States can get away with it, then anyone can get away with it. So this must be pursued in the international courts. It's interesting to see that Iran is doing just that.
Yet as the anniversary approaches and ultimately passes, Iran has clearly stated that it will pursue its legal duty to fight for justice for the assassination of General Soleimani. And the memory of the talented and much respected general will live on forever in the hearts of those seeking to continue his mission of making the region a safer place to live. The humiliating defeat for Donald Trump that saw Joe Biden sweep to a landslide victory is a sign of just how poor the decisions made have been perceived by the people of the US. Yet as the commander-in-chief of the US military, his decision to call the strike on General Soleimani was a decision that severely dented his international reputation. But as his last few days in office approach, US boats in the Persian Gulf have started maneuvers in the region, suggesting that Trump is looking for one last act of power prior to his departure, believing that until now, he's gotten away with his heinous acts. But for Iran, the most wicked act of all has yet to be dealt with. The assassination of General Soleimani has yet to see Iran take revenge for the murder, and is something that Iran has stated cannot be rushed and will happen in a matter of time.
I think we can say that currently Iran is taking action against the United States by pursuing this assassination in the courts. Someone must be held responsible and accountable for the assassination. Iran is going through the proper channels to do so. That is certainly one method that Iran can take to rectify this situation. The United States, on the other hand, if it's going to invade Iran, it's going to happen in the next 19 days which is the last of Donald Trump's administration. While I don't expect things will improve greatly under a Biden administration, they will certainly improve somewhat, probably to the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
But for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the hero of people from across the region and the rest of the world, his ongoing work is being continued by devoted followers and freedom fighters from Iraq to Syria and Palestine to Yemen. And this continuation will be one of the best forms of revenge. Furthermore, with General Soleimani being a champion of fighting terrorism in the region, as well as resisting the US presence in the area, it seems that the sweetest revenge of all has been the victory over the US-backed Daesh group and the American assets in the region leaving the area, providing a safe, free, and healthy living environment for the people of the region. The Israeli regime has always prided itself on being the home of the latest cyber technology, boasting about its capabilities in both aggressive and defensive cyber warfare. However, it seems that the regime has counted its eggs a little too early, as a sophisticated hack has shown the real side of Israeli cybersecurity. The hack, which appears to have taken place over a period of months, appears to be from a source known as Pay to Key, with the hackers deploying a form of highly sophisticated ransomware designed to extract high quantities of information from its target, as well as demanding £100,000 in Bitcoin to stop leaks going public. It seems that the hack targeted a cybersecurity company by the name of Portnox, which itself appears to be a major provider of cybersecurity to multiple Israeli regime offices, including the Israeli aerospace industry, El Al, Bezaq, and Clalit Healthcare, many of which have direct links to the Israeli regime and defense systems. Evidence also suggests that much of the information which is threatening to be leaked contains secret information about various Israeli defense networks and companies, which, although not apparent to what exact details are involved, could see highly classified and sensitive Israeli secrets flooded into the public domain. A spokesman for another Israeli cybersecurity company, Clear Sky, announced that the damage done by the hackers has caused significant damage to the Israeli regime and has pointed the finger of blame at Iran as the origin of the attack, raising the question as to just what right does Israel have to put the onus on Iran after the acts the Israeli regime has committed on the country, including, of course, the famous Stuxnet bug, which targeted Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program.
Even if Iranians were responsible for this latest cyber attack, and indeed the Israeli press has not ascertained culpability yet, and so it said clearly that it can't determine whether or not Iranians were involved, but even if Iranians were involved in this latest cyber attack, Israel would be in no position to complain about it, having taken the cyber gloves off, if you will, by initiating cyber war directly against Iran in 2009 and 10 with the Stuxnet sabotage cyber campaign. This was a campaign of the United States and Israel under the code name Operation Olympic Games, which was designed to destroy elements of Iran's civilian nuclear energy program.
The finger of blame has been pointed at Iran yet again, this time by the Israeli regime. Yet just earlier this month, the US also pointed towards Iran for a series of hacks that were alleged to have breached US voting procedures and officials, something that Iran denied as nonsense. But it seems that Israel is no stranger to cyber attacks themselves, with others predating the Pay 2Key attack. Earlier this year, more than 1,000 Israeli websites were hacked, with images of Tel Aviv in flames, warning Israel that the countdown to destruction had begun, with the Israeli building up a host of enemies due to its hostile actions around the world, from the displacement of people in Palestine to the participation of acts of state-sponsored terrorism. Is it any wonder that Tel Aviv is on the radar of multiple hackers from unknown locations? With such attacks proving that the Israeli regime is both ill-equipped to deal with attacks and too hasty in claiming to be a world leader in security-related issues, has the regime then lost its place at the top of the charts when it comes to cyber and electronic technology?
I believe that this latest hack demonstrates that truly all systems are vulnerable to potential cyber attack. And considering the fact that Israel prides itself so much on its high technology and its cybersecurity, this just proves that even the Israeli cybersecurity can be broken. And so this raises the question, why play with fire, especially when fire will be fought with fire?
There's no doubt that the hack is, and may further yet to prove, a huge embarrassment for the Israeli regime, in particular as the details of the information obtained is yet to be revealed by the hackers, and is similar in nature to a recent hack on US bodies, which the US alleged originated from Russia. Yet with allegations flying around, the priority now for the Israeli regime is to hope that the information obtained does not fall into the public domain, and further shame the regime that appears to have no shame.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum Pressure Campaign denied them access to the vaccines, and so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People will learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances.